I don't need to live in this physical realm. I walk around in the physical realm, and I put on the faces, and I talk, and I play, and I, yeah, it's just a big act, man.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
In the spiritual world is where I live. I exist in places you never even dreamed of.
And then to sort of move into the other part of the book, this is another cool aspect of the book. It's like a dual book in a way. It's paranormal, and then it's also sort of a true crime book, because there's a lot of crime that went on here in the Freetown State Forest that is abnormal crime. It's not your run-of-the-mill crime you expect to know about or hear about. And I guess we'll sort of jump in at what may be the onus for a lot of this crime activity. And this sort of cult aspect that's going on in the Freetown State Forest, or was going on in the Freetown State Forest in the 80s, and maybe before then, maybe after then, I don't know, I'm going to ask you. Start first with talking about the cult activity in the Freetown State Forest, because that's a big part of the book and a big part of the forest.
Right. I would say that it's almost impossible to say that the cults are gone. Specifically, the negative cults or the satanic cults have entirely left the forest. I don't think that that's true. I think you still have very low-level, non-criminal elements that worship Satan and are in the forest. And first off, I should say that, you know, there's nothing inherently illegal or criminal about worshiping Satan. And that it's a First Amendment right, and more power to you if that's what you believe. I'm glad people at least believe something sometimes.
Yeah, hey, that's cool. We have no problem with that. Go ahead.
But there was a lot of bad things that happened in the forest in the name of Satan. And that's the kind of stuff that I really try to focus on in the book. And so there are these cults, and the cults go back, probably predate, you know, and I hate to even mention the name because now it seems like I'm attaching the two, but predates the Church of Satan and Anton LaVey's and his activities. Mm-hmm. It's kind of always been there. You know, Alan Alves, who was one of the investigators in Freetown, one of the detectives in Freetown, said he was documenting this stuff in the early 70s when he first started on the force, and he would see them as already an established religion within the force. It's not like they were newcomers there. Everyone on the force knew about them, that they were in the force doing this stuff. So at least the low-level people have been there, you know, for the past 30 years, if not longer. The more organized cults seem to have moved in somewhere in the mid-70s, and they're long gone now, specifically probably after 1988, and kind of, which I've now dubbed the Year of Satan, because I've just started documenting all of this criminal satanic activity that happened in the year 1988. It's one of those things where if you see the cult, then you're not really seeing the cult. A lot of the activity kind of came to a head in the late 80s, and then they're kind of into the early 90s. But it had been there for such a long time that no one can really tell when it started.
Yeah. Extrapolate a little bit on what you said just now, where if you can see the cult, you're not actually seeing the cult. Talk a little bit about what you mean by that.
Sure. If you believe, and I guess you should talk a little bit about Alan Alves, who should have been just a small-town police officer. He shouldn't have had much to do with his day. He should have gone home and kissed his wife at 5 o'clock when the shift was over. And here was a man who not only investigated almost 20 homicides in his time on the force, which is unheard of for a town this small, but he also, because of the nature of many of these crimes, had to become an expert on occult crime. So in other words, this guy was going out there. It's a small little, I mean, it's a small little rural town, really kind of opie kind of thing going on, and he is becoming an expert on witchcraft and the paranormal and satanic activity across the United States and demonology and all these things that had nothing to do with law enforcement and everything to do with this weird tide of occult happenings that were happening in the United States. And this guy was becoming an expert on it. So if you listen to what he says, and I listen to what he says, I put a lot of weight into what he says, that there are different levels of cult activity. And one of these cults is highly organized and basically in control of a lot of the crime and a lot of the drug running and prostitution in that area of Massachusetts. And it's both kind of this satanic cults are a way of not only unifying the people that are in charge, but also of constantly getting a flow of people and material to kind of use in that area.
Yeah.
And Alan Alves actually even talks about an even higher cult, which is much more kind of, you know, based on this kind of Illuminati, you know, five rulers of the world kind of thing, which he actually believes the cult goes up that high. But we're at least able to kind of tap into this, at least this one that's basically in control of southeastern Massachusetts. And it's very interesting because when you peel off a layer, something else comes up. So one of the classic cases that's in that area that I link to the paranormal and I link to cult activity, even though he doesn't, is the case of James Cater, who was abducted this one woman, was put in jail for it, and then as soon as he got out, he abducted this other young girl and killed her. Well, as I was talking to Alan last time I saw him, and actually you were with me at the radio taping, he turns to me and he says, "Oh yeah, you know that he was connected to the mafia, and he was connected to organized crime." And boom, snap my finger again. There's another connection that perhaps all of this stuff is also, you know, tied into organized crime in kind of a traditional classic sense, too.
Yeah. When we were talking that weekend, you kind of raised the issue that I think someone had mentioned it to you, that the possibility that the cult activity may be used as a cover for drug running and that sort of thing to divert the police from one
right.
thing to the other. And you kind of – I see parallels between this and the Hell's Angels, how they started out as sort of like a little motorcycle club and it turned into like quite a massive enterprise of drug running and other criminal activity. Perhaps a situation like that.
Right. I think that the one thing that can't be ignored is the fact that groups tap into a negative energy there. So I don't think it's entirely just the space that people put on.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more of a cult finds its way to the forest and then finds a way to finance itself. So I think that there are very scary, very human elements to the satanic cults that are there, and I think that they're in charge of a lot of the drugs, a lot of the prostitution, child pornography, running through the New Bedford Fall River area, which had its home. These people who were doing this thing had their home in the Freetown State Forest. So in other words, they were cult members who then got into crime, as opposed to vice versa.
Yeah.
But one of the interesting things was I was talking to a police detective, and he said, "Oh yeah, I worked on that case." He was actually, I think, referring to the highway killings, and he said, "I was the first person on the scene for one of those." No, he was the Carl Drew. I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah," and I was put on the task force to investigate that. And I was like, "Well, what happened?" You know, "Oh, well, we didn't find anything." He said, "But I really, you know, we were really kind of working on this other stuff, and I was part of the drug task force that Alan Niles had formed, and I got taken off of that and put on this." He's like, "Oh, yeah, you know, all the time we were taking off of these things and putting on these, you know, put on these serial killer cases and these weird cult cases," and I started to think, "Hey, wait a minute. If I was going to run a drug enterprise, or if I was going to run a prostitution enterprise, and I'm not talking to local pimp down the street, I'm talking, you know, millions of dollars running in and out of that area of the world,
yeah,
an area of the state, that seems like a great way to keep the cops occupied. Create something, create a phantom for them to follow, create a ghost for them to try to investigate while so that you can kind of sneak under and do your dirty deeds under the cover of night." And I think there's an element to that in Freetown, but I think that it's also a crime of opportunity in terms of all that stuff was going to happen anyway. They were just using it.
Yeah, and when you talk about like cult activity for someone like me, who's pretty docile creature, what exactly would you describe as like cult activity? I'm trying to I would like to be maybe a random witness to this, but in a safe way. Like, if I'd like to see a video of it, I wouldn't want to be there. What would you describe as like the cult activity going on in the Freetown State Forest? Rituals and sacrifices and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think in its most gentle form, you have people who go out there, usually in a group, a small group, set a few fires, chant a little bit, hold hands, live off the energy, and maybe engage in some, you know, kind of sexual activity or something, maybe drugs, something that harms no one but the people that are involved in the ceremony.
Yeah,
they might
like
even
a good time.
Well, right. Sounds like actually what I'm planning on for tomorrow night. Minus the forest, but and there might be, you know, there's an element of vampirism to it too, where sometimes they cut themselves and drink each other's blood. Something that is creepy and yet not really illegal and doesn't really, there's really no long-lasting negative effects to it psychologically to them. Then that kind of goes up to the next level. The next level would be The sacrificing of small animals, chickens, rabbits, and these carcasses are found all throughout the forest, killed in unnatural ways. So obviously, if you're in a forest, you're going to find dead animals. But not dead animals pinned to trees like they were crucified,
yeah.
Which is what they found. Or birds sacrificed in the middle of pentagrams. This is all documented stuff. I've got pictures upon picture of these kind of scenes that Alan or other police detectives came upon. Then you go to kind of the next level and you start seeing cattle found in the forest. Dead, mutilated, completely drained of their blood without a drop of it on the floor, without a drop of it in the forest. So in other words, people who are experts at extracting that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Now you know you're dealing with people that are a lot more serious about what they're doing.
And to jump in, that kind of raises another issue that I had read in the book and I wanted to ask you, because when we talk about the cattle mutilation phenomenon, a lot of times it's like, well, local authorities blamed it on cults and stuff like that. And I always kind of poo-pooed that. But then after I read your book, it was kind of like, well, maybe there is something to that. I find it intriguing that they would have a way of removing all the blood like that, and that maybe there is more to cattle mutilations being the product of cults than the product of, you know, nefarious government plans or aliens or something like that.
I mean, I think that the way Alan describes it, the way Alan Alves goes through the whole process of how you could extract the blood from a cow without ever spilling a drop of it and collect it and carry it away with you, you have to believe that it's at least possible that cults are doing it, because it makes complete sense. You basically tap into the jugular, and with every beat of that cow's heart, it's basically, you know, filling up your jug.
Yeah.
And you can do it without if you're good enough at it, you can do it without spilling a drop of it. Also, you can also consider the fact that it's done somewhere else and then the animal's dumped.
Yeah.
Where these animals are found, it's not someone who's, you know, driving a Pinto.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Carrying this. I mean, so even that in of itself has some kind of level of organization to it. It's unexplained, you know? And yet, if you kind of take it with the other elements of things that are going on, in other words, if you find that, and then you find, an underground bunker where you find all this weird satanic material, in very close to where those cattle are found, well, now you're starting to look away from the government and away from aliens and putting more weight into the cult part of it.
Yeah, totally. Like the cattle mutilations, if you will, for lack of a better term, that you describe in the book or that happened in the Freetown State Forest, those seem absolutely most likely to be cults than, you know, an alien or something. They wouldn't just pick up the cow from somewhere else and leave it in the woods or something like that.
Right, and yet not all that glitters is gold, so I don't think that we can entirely say that every cattle mutilation is the work of a cult.
Yeah, totally. It probably runs the gamut anyway.
Right.
Well, let's talk about, you already sort of talked about the James Cater case. Let's talk about the Carl Drew case, because that sounds like, was he the one that gave you the picture when I was there at the radio station?
Yeah, it's really kind of weird. I mean, he's been on me to write his life story. So if you buy the book, it has this really great cover, and the picture that's on the cover there is by this guy who lives in that area, who goes kind of like by the handle sometimes, Carl Slave. And so basically, he's this person who's very much into Carl Drew, who made contact with him in jail, and I've kind of been leading this or going through this kind of relationship with this convicted murderer in jail to the point that last week or a few weeks ago he sent me read the book, liked it, and sent me a picture just kind of say, hey, how you doing? Nice book. You know, good luck to you. Which is kind of freaky, you know? I mean, even if you're investigating ghosts or you're investigating whatever, you kind of want it on the outside.
Yeah.
You want it, you know, to not be in your bedroom. You want it to not be in your closet when you open it to get your shirt out in the morning. So it's very much, you know, kind of like breaking down that fourth wall of the paranormal to have him do that. Because it's easy in my book to put forth that everything I'm about to say is true, and yet he's still a convicted murderer. But Carl Drew was a man who was a pimp in the Fall River, New Bedford area, New Bedford specifically, in the late 70s and then into the early 80s. And he was in charge of a small group of prostitutes. He was kind of a drug dealer, pimp, and general kind of a bad, sketchy guy on the corner, kind of running things. A few of the women who were under him began disappearing. And as he got more and more into the investigation, they started to realize that a lot of the prostitutes and a lot of the drug dealers in that area were all belonged to the satanic cult. And they would sometimes meet in the apartment of one of the people that was kind of involved in all this stuff. And other times they would meet in this shack in the Freetown State Forest. And they would conduct all these rituals, and supposedly one of them had been killed during these rituals. During these rituals, one of the prostitutes had been killed as the ultimate sacrifice. And then another one was. And then one who was going to turn on them, she was killed. And so there's this kind of back and forth as they investigated, once again, peeling away the kind of story to start to realize there was something bigger going on. And Carl Drew, basically everyone turned against him. They received a lot of pressure from the police and a lot of pressure from the district attorney, who were, you know, basically using everything under the book to get this guy convicted, because he looked very much and acted very much like a Charles Manson head of a cult type.
Yeah.
You know, he was a great fall guy and a great lean on if you were looking to convict someone of it. And so they convicted him mainly on the testimony of hookers and druggies and, you know, these people who are just kind of lowlifes. Whereas now most people feel that he actually was not the head of the cult, but it was one of the people who testified against him, who was this 17-year-old, charismatic, bisexual woman who used kind of sex and drugs and Satan to control these group of people, to the point that she was even manipulating the police and the district attorney into kind of allowing all this stuff to happen. And her name is Robin Murphy. And she is now going on for almost 4 years out of jail, because she copped the plea and got less time. So he's in jail still serving out his term for the murder, and she's just recently released. And a lot of people in that area feel like, of course, every criminal says they didn't do it,
yeah,
and that they're innocent and that they were caught up in the whirlwind and everyone's out to get them. And but there are a lot of people in law enforcement in that area, a lot of people who even were involved in the case in terms of, like, they believed it at the time, who now think that Carl Drew didn't do it. And he's in a jail cell, and he's kind of serving his time, and he's trying to talk to anyone who will listen. And Robin Murphy's out there, and she's basically, you know, free to roam. So,
since you're not shy about pointing the finger at her, have you heard anything from her, or have you gotten any response from, you know, associates of her or her camp?
I haven't heard. I mean, I'm expecting that shoe to eventually drop. and I guess you know, the best thing I can say about it is if trouble starts to happen, it means that someone's reading my book and buying it, so that's good. But I really think it's a trick of the media to be able to do this, because I never say in the book, and I never say even in this interview we've just talked, if you go back and listen to it, that Robin Murphy did it. Instead, I say authorities believe that Robin Murphy did it.
Yeah.
Because all I'm doing is reporting what other people have told me. So if she wants to come forward and tell her side of the story, I would love to hear it. I would love to document it. I would love to write Dark Woods 2, The Next Generation, and explore all these other sides of the case. But as far as I know, she hasn't kind of prepared anything for me, and no one's contacted me on her behalf.
Okay, yeah. I was just wondering, you know, since you heard from him, I didn't know if you were hearing from her at all, or I'd be kind of tweaked if I did, so.
You know, I kind of feel like, you know, I don't think that the right hand often knows what the left hand is doing, and I'm very specific about using those hands when I say that. I think that in terms of the Carl Drew, Robin Murphy cult being part of the larger picture, I think she had no idea that she was herself being manipulated.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think that to say that it's a really haunted area and there's a lot of crime going on and it's very weird and there's cults all fine there and they're completely unrelated to each other is a bit naive. I mean, I believe that a lot of these cults that are working there, these slightly organized cults, are being manipulated by the larger cult. So if you take a drug-using prostitute who is the head of a cult and not think that she can be influenced by an outside force without her really fully understanding how she's being used, then you're not really looking at the case very closely. So I think the potential is there for, especially considering we've already discussed, that cult might be into prostitution and drug running.
Yeah, so it's almost like a situation where maybe the upper level of the cult might be like, you know, we need you to do this. And,
right.
And it happens, and she doesn't, you know, she doesn't know why really, but she just does it at the behest of whoever her higher-ups are.
Right, and it's one of those situations where even cult members don't know who other cult members are. There's a rotating membership. And these are not abstract people. These are not people who, wear robes. Some of the cult members you can talk to. You can go into their businesses in Rhode Island and talk to them. They're not going to tell you about the cult, but these people are people that Alan Iles has investigated and arrested and taken out of the forest. People who, are not shy about their involvement with the occult, at least. And they're just walking the streets, but of course you can't convict them on something. You can't convict someone on dust, on air, there's no proof that links them other than, the stories and stuff that can't be used in court.
Yeah, it's a spooky world. It's spooky. What about the other big case you sort of talk about here, and that's one that's gone unsolved so far, and that's the Highway Killer case?
There's actually been several serial killers in Massachusetts, and some people even think that that the Highway Killer might be responsible for some of the later cases. Some of these random serial killings might actually be the work of one person. I fully think that the Highway Killer is actually the Highway Killers. I'm one of the few people that put forward that it is all the work of a cult. And it was all very specifically done during a certain time to bring about what the cult wanted. We've already kind of talked about 1988 as being this very crucial year for some reason for satanic activity in Massachusetts and then all throughout the country. That's when these killings were happening. So we're talking at least 17 bodies found of prostitutes or drug users, female drug users, all throughout Bristol County and then a little bit into, Plymouth County and then into Rhode Island even. And that's just the body count of people that they know.
Mm-hmm.
Because Freetown is a great place to drop a body and have it never be found. So most law enforcement that work in the area believe that there are bodies that will just never be found that are in the forest.
Wow.
At least 17 bodies and two district attorneys actually as well have all died at the hands of the serial killer in Massachusetts who, if not for the body count, really is kind of a boring serial killer. There's not that kind of attraction to it. He's a straightforward, strangle kind of serial killer. But these bodies started turning up all throughout the early parts and later parts of 1988. And they had kind of some prime suspects, and the case was handled really poorly by the district attorney at the time, who kind of zeroed in on one person because he had a personal grudge against him. It allowed kind of a lot of the other evidence, especially what Alan Iles was saying, kind of allowed that to fall by the wayside and kind of pushed him off the case because he was so focused on these one or two people for personal things. Then one of them committed suicide, and that was it. Okay, he was a suspect, did it out of guilt, case closed. Well, case closed for them in a way, but not for the people of Bristol County, not for the people that lived in this area who still think of him as this weird boogeyman who just roams the streets. So whenever there's a killing, people's eyes turn towards this unsolved case of the Highway Killer and say, that's him, he's risen again, and he's coming after us again. A classic example of it is Bish, when the lifeguard who died a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that was more towards kind of the Worcester County area. But there were people in Bristol County who were saying, that's the work of the Highway Killer. So it's very much alive in the kind of subconscious of Massachusetts, especially that part of Massachusetts, when these bodies start to kind of appear that, it's the Highway Killer rearing his ugly head again. But the actual person who might be responsible, once again, it's really difficult to convict and to kind of bring it out because all the evidence is kind of discovered or kind of come about in a very sketchy way. I don't want to make people think that Alan Iles is, the white knight walking, riding in on the horse and saving the day. He's as good as he is because he's somewhat sketchy himself. He can get into the mind of a criminal because he was a criminal when he was younger. And so people tell him a lot of stuff off the record in ways that can never be used in court, and then he tries to find a way to make it usable.
Yeah.
So the new district attorney, who just recently came into power about a year ago, who ran on the platform of, I will solve the Highway Killer. It was actually his thing. This guy said he would do it. How long are we going to have to go before it's being solved? Elect me and I will solve it. He's actually kind of maybe evaluating some of the stuff that Alan had and saying, okay, you feel you know who it is, now let's work backwards.
Yeah.
And this, if you follow this man throughout kind of the years after the highway killing kind of
era.
Kind of like the era, the flap. I was trying to use a word that you would like. If you follow his movements throughout different states, you see very similar activity happening in those states at that time.
Yeah. So Alan Alice thinks he has a bead on who it probably is.
Yeah. Yep. And he has law enforcement in other states that have contacted him saying, hey, we hear you're this weird, you know, this expert in the cult. Here's our crimes. Bah, 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 bah. Here are our suspects. He's like, oh, really? That guy's a suspect, huh? Huh. All right. Well, you know, he used to live in Massachusetts. And so, I mean, it's one of those things where it's really difficult whether it ever will, but that's his kind of Moby Dick. That's his kind of journey is to, now that he's retired, to devote time to catching the killer who got away.
Yeah. Interesting. And do you think that they ever will get to the bottom of it, or do you think it's the sort of situation where, like, I don't know who this mystery suspect is, so maybe they'll pass away in 5 or 10 years and then it'll all come out in the wash then or something?
You know, I think that this crime, especially crime that's attached to a cult, is such a delicate house of cards when you're trying to explain it and when you're trying to discover it, that there are so many things that can go wrong. For example, if you're James Cater and you killed under the guise of being part of a cult, why haven't you said anything in 20 years about it?
Yeah.
Why hasn't the leader of the cult put a bullet through your brain so you don't say anything? I think that there's someone in jail in the next 5 years who will mysteriously die or will die from a suicide or will be, will get killed somehow, and it will be passed off, and it will be the highway killer. And there'll be someone inside doing the work of the cult to kind of get him out of the way. And so therefore the case will never be solved.
Interesting. Would Alan come out and say who it was if the guy dies?
I'm not sure. You'd have to ask him that.
Yeah, I didn't know if that was something.
I wouldn't do it.
Because they kind of did that. The guy who wrote this is off the beaten path here, but the guy who wrote the Zodiac book, when his prime suspect for the Zodiac killing died, that's when he wrote the book and said who he thought it was. So I didn't know if that was that sort of thing.
Right.
I'm sure there's legal hurdles to that kind of thing anyway.
Yeah, I think that the rejuvenated kind of interest in the case, first by the new district attorney and second by the huge media blitz that is Dark Woods, maybe will bring some of these questions back up and some people will come forward with evidence that might link it, and therefore we can kind of put a fast track on finding this guy, or at least convicting this guy because we know who it is. Hopefully we won't have to wait until the guy dies, but I feel that Alan, you know, will probably say it if the guy were to pass away, yes.
Not
to speak for him, but yes, he would, most
right.
likely.
Yeah, I was asking you to venture a guess anyway. And not to, I don't want you to say anything like who it is or anything, but has Alan told you, you know, the specifics of his suspect, or is it something where he just tells you that he has someone in mind that he thinks is it?
No, I know specifics, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I don't want you to say anything because I
can't. No. Yeah, I don't even know. I know a bit about it. I know the whole background of it and pretty much the name. So.
All right. Well, we'll leave it at that, and people can do their own research.
But don't buy the book thinking that I say who it is.
Yeah, don't buy the book thinking that. It's not in the book. It's, you know, we're trying to avoid being victims 19 and 20 here. So hopefully. So we'll just leave it at that. And then this cult thing, like we kind of talked about the higher level and that sort of thing, and there's a long history in paranormal circles about that sort of thing where, you know, kind of like what you said, what Alan thinks, where like it's an Illuminati sort of thing. But I guess my question is, as far as the cults in the Freetown State Forest and all that stuff, were these guys like mostly, were these guys and gals, were they mostly, you know, unsavory characters, you know, drug runners, pimps, prostitutes, or were there, you know, upstanding citizens standing alongside them in the rituals and all that stuff?
Yeah, I'd say it's much more that the cult itself consists of enough people who are respectable that it would make you lose sleep.
Really?
So there really is no distinction between unsavory character and policeman, in elected official. And so, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, the, some of the people who you would count on being the most trustworthy pillars of the community are the ones that are, you know, more sketchy than the drug dealer you see on the street. The drug dealer you see on the street is pretty straightforward. You know where he's coming from.
Yeah.
Now it's the one that you vote for. that has the secret life. Who only reason why he's there in the first place is because he's part of this cult. That's the person who you have to watch out for. That's the frightening one.
Now, what do you mean he's only there in the first place because he's part of the cult? Because he has the, you know, connections to get elected, or because, you know, he's harnessed some kind of dark power to get elected?
You know, and I kind of think this is where Alan and I split. I think that dark power can be used, and he feels it can't. But it's much more just because of the influence of the cult in the community itself.
Yeah.
So, but I also feel there's an aspect of gaining some kind of power through ritual and tapping somehow into something darker.
Yeah. So this thing's got quite a lot of tentacles in this area. It's not just, it's on first glance, like you said, when you see the cult, you're not really seeing the cult. On first glance, you think it's just, you know, lowlifes and weirdos and stuff like that and hippies. But really, it sounds like this thing runs the gamut of characters.
Well, I mean, you know, you have to keep in mind that we're talking about the Freetown State Forest in a certain period of time. But if you really kind of look at the history of Massachusetts, at the same time that this stuff was going on, you had, you know, the classic cases of sexual abuse in Malden and some of the areas closer to Boston that were having this kind of satanic twist to it. We were coming off satanic activity in the kind of the New Hampshire Massachusetts line and the Lawrence and New and Andover area. You were coming off of areas where, what do we have if you go kind of 10 miles north and west of that? You have the hills and where they lived. You know what I'm saying? And all the activity that was happening in Exeter, New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And the very open satanic cult that was active there in the late 70s and early 80s. So I think that, you know, this is kind of a picture of, or a snapshot of a lot of activity that was happening. And so I think that kind of, you know, if you watch this stuff from afar, you see that the people who are being accused are often, you know, really, really low or really hidden in the documents are people who are highly respected and members of kind of the police and members of the government and members of, you know, and this is not just the flashy killings. This is, you know, document upon document of people accusing, and, you know, and sometimes cases that ended with district attorneys, you know, disappearing or attorney generals being thrown off cases and ended up having to go into private practice because they couldn't get a job someplace. So there is definitely kind of this weird, unexplained, you know, conspiracy theory kind of twist everything.
Yeah, and it kind of explains why this sort of thing still remains in the background, still remains in the dark, and that these stories, the Drew case, the Cater case, you know, they were kind of, they're not getting rehashed, if you will, or you know what I mean? It's kind of like
right.
They've been shuffled off to the shadows now because they don't want to get, they don't want to have anyone else to really digging into it again.
It's a, you know, and not only, you know, are you going to touch upon someone who might be someone very important right now, but it also reflects just really badly on the communities. You know, the fact that there's a serial killer who can outwit the district attorney's office and kill that many people, that's a big black eye
yeah.
to the law enforcement. But ultimately, you have to really think that, okay, sure, drug money and prostitution and the money gained from all that and the power gained from all that, that's excellent. But they could be doing this in a lot of different ways, but they choose this Satanism to kind of bathe themselves in doing this. Well, the ultimate goal of Satanism is fear and disorder and chaos and paranoia and all these things that not being able to put your finger and hunt the cult down does to the community. That stuff is happening, and that stuff is the energy that that these people use, and their ultimate goal is kind of playing itself out in this, in southeastern Massachusetts and in the forest.
Yeah, it's scary stuff. It's really scary stuff because it goes beyond what we call paranormal in a way. You know, you can, I mean, I'm sure I'd be freaked out if I saw a UFO or a Bigfoot or something like that, but it's not scary in the way cults and murders and you know, that's human. There's a human element to that that's more frightening, I think, than UFOs and Bigfoot.
Right. It's kind of like, you know, it's once again that thing that you know, unless you're hardcore into something that you can't explain, and you don't expect to hear a knock at the door, and you open it up, and there's a Bigfoot.
Yeah.
And he's yelling at you to stop talking about him. But that's a real possibility, you know, with this kind of stuff, you know. And yet, Alan did this stuff for years, and I think only had really one threat from someone who was cult related at him. You know what I'm saying? So it's not entirely, I don't feel the danger. I don't feel the danger talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I was gonna say.
I like to think I'm so low on their radar that, you know, sometimes I guess you hope that you're not doing the cult bidding by talking about this stuff and putting it back out there.
Yeah, that's true, because you could also be doing what they want you to do in the sense that you're, you know, re-educating a whole new generation of people to that fear.
Right, right. But it's, I mean, like you said, it's very weird to kind of, you know, you're going in one direction with this stuff. I remember walking into Alan Al's office, and he's now a professional hypnotist. So we went from cop to hypnotist. So, you know, there's definitely something weird with that, too. And I went into his office, and we talked. And the first day, he pulls out, you know, these three huge boxes of old cases. And in these cases were some of the weirdest kind of things that we talked about. Everything from, you know, sexual abuse to someone's self-mutilation and dumping the blood all over a nativity scene to decapitating a grave. And you're like, okay, dude, I wanted to talk to you about ghosts, and I thought that you were connected with that somehow, and now you're handing this stuff off to me?
Yeah.
When that kind of falls in your lap, it's easy to make the leap and start thinking that perhaps ghosts and zombies and puckwudgies and serial killers are somehow all related.
Yeah, and you bring and that kind of that's a good segue to my next point here in the notes, and that's just this weird connection here between crime and paranormal activity and that energy that's going on there in Freetown and the Freetown State Forest. What do you make of that? How do you wrap your mind around that? Is it a chicken and an egg situation? Are they drawn there from the energy, or does the energy draw them there? Does that rise in paranormal activity give rise to crime, or is the crime an effect of the paranormal activity? I mean, these are rhetorical questions I'm sort of just throwing at you.
Right, and it's one of those things that ultimately you have to just sit back, observe it, and say it comes from the same emotional or same energy core.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to chase your own tail like a cat, you have to kind of admit that that will never be solved. I'll never be able to. One of the classic questions I'm always asked when I talk about this is, well, where did it start?
Yeah.
You know, what was the first thing? What is the reason for all this? And which is another thing that makes Freetown so interesting is that it does touch upon there was tragedy there. So if you're a tragedy buff, you can latch onto that and investigate, and you kind of have a reason. If you're an energy person there, I mean, you definitely have, you know, geology that kind of taps into it. Granite and water sources and potentially ley lines. And, you know, you can kind of attach yourself to that and attach your cart to that horse and go away with it. So it's really one of those things where I've stopped kind of exploring the why, and I kind of am just kind of holding everything up to the light. And I'm hoping that in holding it up to the light, we might not be able to come to any answers, but we can start to kind of see this connection and understand it and maybe apply it to other places.
Yeah.
And you can start to see, I mean, I feel like just in doing this kind of stuff, I can go just over the border to a town that used to be a free town, part of Freetown, and you can start to, say, reevaluate Lizzie Borden and the case there and say, okay, well, maybe Lizzie did do it, and she was under the same kind of negative influence because that house itself has had several tragedies attached to it. So it allows you to kind of investigate the paranormal or investigate, you know, some aspect of cryptozoology with a different and hopefully stronger perspective on a relationship scale.
The other big picture thing I kind of want to talk to you about outside of Dark Woods is just your experience here in the Massachusetts paranormal scene, because you've been in the field for quite a while now, so you've seen the ups and downs and the explosion, really, of paranormal,
right,
of the paranormal scene, especially I feel like it may be more in Massachusetts than in other parts of the country. It's big all over the place. Don't get me wrong. It's huge in most states. But I feel like with the Gothic background and the Salem thing and a lot of the, the history here in Massachusetts, because we're part of like the oldest part of the country, probably have a little more history and thus maybe more of an interest in the paranormal scene. But, you know, I've always been sort of interested in the national scope of the whole thing. I haven't really taken a look at the regional picture of it, but I know that you've been a part of the Massachusetts paranormal scene for well over a decade. I guess just talk about your experience in the scene with the people and stuff like that and how you've seen the evolution of the field over the time that you've been a part of it.
Well, I think I'm in a unique position because I've been alternating local book with national book. So I've been able to kind of not only cultivate some very strong relationships with people in the Massachusetts paranormal community, but also to kind of look at Massachusetts' place in the country.
Yeah.
And you start to see paranormal themes develop in different parts of the country. Mm-hmm. And everyone kind of attach, maybe link their history with why there are ghosts. So, for example, it's very, very popular in the South to associate ghostly activity with demonic activity. If you have a ghost, it's a demon. And in the Midwest, it's very much attached to, I should say, the Pacific Northwest. Going the Southwest, it's very much attached to Native Americans. Pacific Northwest, very attached to settlers and the gold rush and things like that. And in Massachusetts, we have such these cycles of history that have happened here that you can't really put a finger on overall what the connection is between the Massachusetts history and its ghosts.
Yeah.
In other words, we have these very, you know, this classic Native American aspect to our paranormal community. Every place was built on an ancient Indian burial ground in Massachusetts. But then you also have, you know, this very Puritan thing that kind of sweeps through and goes into Rhode Island as well. So you have the witch hunt and you have this kind of settler aspect to things. And then you have, you know, this kind of modernization and this civil war and revolutionary war and all these things that kind of sweep through Massachusetts and affect it. And it's very much this kind of hodgepodge of all the great stuff. So it's really this kind of microcosm for all the activity in the country kind of happens here in Massachusetts first, or you can at least find it here. So it's a great place to, be an investigator. You know, and if there are any doubts whether there might be something to this whole Bridgewater Triangle idea or this whole Freetown State Forest as this kind of, you know, thing drawing in negative energy, find Freetown on a map, and you won't be able to find it. So find Fall River, New Bedford, or any of the places that are in southeastern Massachusetts, even Brockton, and draw a 100-mile just circle around it. And you will find probably, and I don't put myself in this circle at all, but you will find the highest concentration of high-profile paranormal investigators. Everyone from John Zaffis and the Warrens in Connecticut to Jeff Belanger in Bellingham, Massachusetts, to some of the great Tom DiAgostino. Some of the classic people have kind of swept through this area or been a part of this area. They all come from within 100 miles of Freetown. And I think that people from Massachusetts always feel everything is better in Massachusetts, but I feel maybe the paranormal is one thing where they might actually be right.
And baseball.
And baseball, right. But, you know, it's even kind of, it's funny, like, even investigating north and south, you know, the groups that are up north are very different from the groups that are down south. You know, and you've been exposed to some of the southeastern Mass, you know, the spooky South Coast guys and some of the, you know, of course, you know, Taps is, you know, probably 10 miles from Freetown, is their home base.
Mm-hmm. It'd
be like 15, 20 miles, actually.
Yeah.
There's this kind of culture and personality to the south side or the south area, southern area of Massachusetts, which is entirely different just from the north. So I'm in a good position where I'm kind of a liaison between those two kind of sides of the paranormal coin, and not having a group but rather being an investigator and a writer has allowed me to cultivate relationships with both people and to see that stuff.
And what would you say the flavor of the north side is? Because I'm only really familiar with the southern guys.
Right. I think that the north is much more kind of connected to the Salem kind of haunting
stuff. Oh, okay, yeah. All right, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Where it's much less about energy and much more about so much has happened on this one spot that it has to be haunted. Whereas the south is much more about something is working and that's why so much stuff has happened on this spot.
Yeah. Okay, I see what you're saying, yeah.
And right, to like Methuen. I work in Lawrence. Methuen's the next town over. great history of hauntings there. I mean, great, like you could walk down the street and you could, you know, basically create your own kind of ghost tour going from all the places that are kind of notoriously haunted there. You know, very different from southeastern Mass, where it's, see that forest? That forest has something dark and unexplained in it. Or see this bridge, these very public places that aren't connected and don't have necessarily industry attached to it. That's kind of the other big thing I would feel probably about the two different areas, kind of a commercialism in the north as opposed to this very evil stuff happening in the south.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I totally see the commercialism part, because Salem's like, oh man, they make their part and parcel on that whole witch trial thing.
I mean, when someone asks me, have you investigated Salem? I say, no, not really. Well, why not? I'm like, okay, well, first of all, it didn't happen in Salem. And second of all, it's been done. I mean, what more can I say? That is such, as a reporter, you would understand this, that's such tainted ground that anything that comes out of there, you know, you have to put so much salt into that, into someone hearing something, that it's kind of not worth my time. But give me a personal thing that happened. Give me a personal story from someone who just happens to live in Salem, and that's very engaging.
Yeah, the witch trial thing, that's like Roswell. You know, it's been done to death.
Right. Although if you think about it, witch trials, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then that happened actually in Danvers and not Salem. And there you have the most haunted building in Massachusetts, you know, with Danvers State Hospital right there.
Yeah.
And the constant tragedy that's befalling that area, so.
There's definitely something going on. Now, what about the explosion here of paranormal groups? Because like you said, you started out with the website and everything. I will bet money that when you started out, there was probably a much smaller number of paranormal groups. I'm sure there were a few. But nowadays, there seems to be a group for every town, if not, you know, and these are small towns. Like, my town's small, as you know, and there's apparently a paranormal group here.
Yeah, I need to tap into them. I need to know where they are. I want to talk to those guys.
I found them by accident, and I'm trying to find them again now. So when I do find them again, I'll let you know. It's weird. Like, one day I just found them and was like, this is bizarre. What are they doing? But I was like, I don't want to contact these people.
Right. I think that... it's funny, my website was really kind of much less about investigating and much more about telling stories, and it was actually originally going to be used as a resource for fiction writers, too. And that's kind of was the concept of a meeting place. And I said, you know, so supply and demand. There are so many national, or there were a few national websites, and then, of course, there's some New England websites. I'm like, hey, no one's just focusing on one area. That's what this stuff needs, is people to focus on just one area.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll do Massachusetts because that's where I live and that's where I love and that's where I've investigated. And so there really were, I think, were at least three or four ones that were about Massachusetts. Now, of course, Jeff Belanger already had his site up at that point. But he's just located in Massachusetts. He has a national and not international focus.
Yeah.
And Obi-Wan's site was up. And once again, she's in Massachusetts, but not a Massachusetts focus. So there was only two or three Massachusetts things, and now it's really exploded. So it's really, I get so many emails from people who want to join my group, or who want me to kind of act as a mentor to their group. And it's kind of, you know, one hand, it's very, like, ooh, can we really do all this? But on the other hand, they're doing a lot of very interesting things that I don't think would be explored if we didn't have kind of this saturation. And eventually the cream will rise to the top, and the people who are the best at it and who really have something to do and something to say intelligently will remain, and the people who are just on it because it's a fad will fall away. So we'll be left with kind of the best of both worlds.
Yeah, so you don't find it as daunting that there's so many groups and that kind of thing.
Yeah, like, see, I don't really care.
Yeah.
Because what I do is I connect with people. And so I don't feel the need to necessarily be like, well, I'm investigating every single weekend, and so I need to compete with anybody.
Yeah.
Go out and spend your time in your cemetery. I want to spend my time tonight interviewing this person who had this very profound experience happen to them, where they saw a ghost or where they touched the other side. Not that I don't like going out to that cemetery and investigating, but it's kind of like the other thing is more, because it has a soul to it, is much more attractive to me.
Yeah, exactly. And it's good that you're not really a part of any group, because then you won't get caught up in the politics of the groups, because it seems to be that's one of the other problems, I guess you could say, with the group explosion. It's just the interpersonal politics that go on is worthy of a book in and of itself that would have nothing to do with ghosts or anything. It would just be, you know.
Well, actually, one of the ones I'm working on now is about kind of the phenomenon of ghost hunting itself, and kind of that aspect to it. It's a how-to guide for paranormal investigators, but it also gets a lot into the sociological aspects of people who investigate and kind of the ideas put forward by these groups, and kind of the group mentality and the kind of, you know, it's just the typical roles of a group playing itself out. You know, if you're going to think about entering a group, never join a group where there's a husband and a wife, for example, you know, like, because you're always going to have that aspect playing itself out. And there's these kind of rules to being in a group, which sometimes are ridiculous and sometimes not.
What do you mean? I gotta ask now. What do you mean by don't join a group if it's run by a husband and wife? Just because you'll always be like the number three guy, or you're gonna be forced to, or you're just gonna be caught up in their own little drama?
Well, right. It's much more of like a drama type of thing. You know, I mean, you don't want to. Do you really want to be? Do you really want to be in the middle of a fight between the two of them?
Yeah.
And they're talking about whether, you know, whether it's a residual haunting or whether it's an intelligent haunting, and what they're really saying is you didn't do the dishes last night.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just impossible to, whatever weight they bring from their marriage, they're now bringing into that investigation. And for me personally, I'm like, that has nothing to do with ghosts. It's completely amazing in and of itself, the whole ghost group phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it's just something that makes me very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because you feel like you have to walk on eggshells. You feel that it's just, you know, it's just an argument playing itself out on a paranormal field, and it really has nothing to do with investigating.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the exciting things about Dark Woods is that you kind of make the transition here from someone who had an online presence and was an investigator and did a lot of writing and was featured in a lot of good publications and stuff, to having your own book and stuff like that. So I guess just talk about the experience of writing your first book and sort of going from, you know, just an investigator to an author now.
Right. Right. And I would actually probably say it's the, you know, a reverse of that, because I always considered and still do consider myself an author first. I am not an investigator who writes, which I think is where there are some where there's mistakes sometimes. I am not a person who investigates ghosts, has some ideas, so I decide to write them down. I am an author. I'm a trained author. I went to school for it. It was my life's passion since I was a little kid. I love to write.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where kind of life has chosen. I never would have assumed that I'd be writing ghosts about books. I thought I'd be writing the classic American novel. But my two passions converged, much like a crossroad, if you will. And that this is kind of where it's been. So it's very, it was very unusual for me to be considered an investigator for a while. And that took some adjusting, because people would say to me, so Christopher Balzano, a researcher or investigator, and be like, no, I'm a writer. And a lot of times it became, I had to apologize for that. No, I'm sorry, I'm a writer. I'm not he's just a writer. He's not a real investigator. Which I always found funny, because I probably spent more time on genuine cases, really knee-deep in things, than a lot of people who were just kind of going out to cemeteries and
yeah.
Documenting activity.
Yeah.
So it's very exciting for me to – a lot of people feel like the book would be the supplement of finding the evidence. I don't think we're going to find evidence that's going to prove there is life after death. Or I don't think there's some kind of Rosetta Stone that is going to make it all make sense. I think ultimately what we're going to be left with is a chronicle of the people during this time. And I want to be the person who's involved in helping to chronicle that. So for me, the book is kind of the end game. And people reading it and enjoying it and being intellectually challenged by it and entertained by it is my goal. So, you know, ultimately I would like to do more books and sell more copies and be able to dedicate myself entirely to this. But seeing it, I saw my book on a bookshelf at a Barnes & Noble. I don't know if I could say a chain like that, but in a bookstore. I saw it on a bookstore on the shelf in the computer of that bookstore for the first time this Monday. And it was amazing, and it was wow. And when I held the book in my hand for the first time, I still have a, you know, I don't allow anyone to touch my review copy that I got, which is really just the first copy of the book. There's nothing special about it. But it was my book. So in terms of making the transition, this is what I feel like I've been trained for my whole life. This is what I've been kind of leading towards. So holding that book is kind of like the culmination of what I've been hoping for quite a long time, much longer than I was hoping to find that crucial piece of evidence that was going to, you know, make the whole ghost scene explode.
Yeah.
That was a very long-winded answer. But
no, but it was a great answer. It was a great answer. It was good. It was good. I was listening to it and thinking, these are going to be in the intro here, some of these parts. And sort of to wrap it all up here, to put a big bow on it, you kind of already touched on the ghost book you have coming up soon, the instructional book. But what's next for you? I know you have a ton of stuff in the pipeline. So let's hear what you have coming up for books and for speaking engagements or anything like that you want to talk about.
I kind of feel a little bit like I'm the Morgan Freeman of the paranormal this year. I think you said it interesting way that there's an up and coming aspect to me. It's going to hit hard. It's really kind of, maybe it was a prophecy. Maybe you've got a little bit of a sixth sense. You know it. But I've got three books that are going to be due this year. So come Halloween, I'll have four books out there for people to enjoy. I have another book by Schiffer, which is coming out around Halloween, which is called A Ghost of the Bridgewater Triangle, which is an examination of just the paranormal, the ghostly side of the paranormal in the same part of Massachusetts that we're talking about. And in the same respect, I've got two national books with major publishers that are coming out. The first one is called Ghostly Adventures, which is due out in July, I believe Amazon is saying, and that's firsthand ghost accounts from across the United States. And so it's kind of like all these different ghost stories and kind of my commentary on them. And then around that same time, which is really insane to me because I just have one chapter finished, but it's probably going to be out before all the other ones because of the publisher. Mm-hmm. It's so huge. Is called Picture Yourself Ghost Hunting, which is a how-to guide along with the DVD that I'm actually producing as well. So you can not only hear about how you investigate and why some of the theories are behind it and all that stuff, but then you can pop in the DVD and you kind of go through the investigations with some local Massachusetts groups and see how you would conduct a good haunting, a good investigation in a cemetery or in a haunted building or in a famous location. So it's kind of like this two-part attack to learning how to be the best ghost hunter out there.
Nice, nice. Well, we need a book like that because there's a lot of not-so-best ghost hunters out there. So whatever.
It's interesting. I thought it would be kind of like this a common sense stuff, because there are so many groups out there, and yet, and I'm always kind of like hesitant to be like, oh, this is what I'm working on. But every time I mention it, whether it's to a group or whether it's to, they're excited that there's going to be something like that out there. You hate to use the expression, but it really is kind of being sold as a, ghost hunting for dummies kind of book, which there isn't, oddly enough.
Yeah, yeah, and there's so many groups. And a general for, there's some interaction, there's some good interaction with the Taps family type stuff, but it's still quite a splintered field, so this is the kind of thing we could use. So
right.
I'm looking forward to that for sure. Well, Chris, like I said, you've been instrumental in helping me get a look into the world of Massachusetts paranormal scene. I consider you probably my closest local friend here in the field, so I've been psyched to have you on the program. And you sort of touched on something that I said back in October, but it's starting to come to fruition now. I'm going to tell you folks, Chris Balzano is definitely going to be one of 2008's breakout stars in the world of esoterica. You've heard him here on the program. He's done a lot of other radio appearances. You're going to be hearing him other big programs, I'm sure. I'm really looking forward to seeing where his road takes him, because it's been just fun meeting him and knowing him for the last year and seeing all this stuff on the horizon. Is just exciting to see. Like I said, folks, breakout star in esoterica in 2008, Chris Balzano. I'm telling you, put it in the bank. I'm telling you, it's a fact. The book we've been talking about tonight is Dark Woods, Cults, Crime, and Paranormal in the Freetown State Forest. It's from Schiffer Books. You can get it pretty much, if you can't find it at Barnes & Noble, tell them to order it, and you can get it there. Or go to Amazon.com and order it from them, or go to Schiffer Books' website, order it from them. It's an awesome book. We just scratched the surface here. There's so much in there that I just wanted to hit on some of the zanier stuff, some of the even odder stuff that he hits on in the book. But there's tons of other stuff that I didn't even get a chance to talk to him about. So it's definitely worth picking up and reading. Like I said, Chris, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. It's something we've been talking about since April. I've been waiting to get my copy of Dark Woods so we could have you on the show. From a personal perspective, I can't thank you enough for your friendship and for your time and for your patience with dealing with me, you know, over the weeks and months and all the adventures that we've been on and surely all the adventures we're going to be on in the future. So I look forward to all that great stuff. Of course, folks, you can find all kinds of information on Chris at his website, www.masscrossroads.com, MASSCROSSROADS.com. Definitely check it out. Tons of great information on all these awesome stories we've been talking about, even more, and information on where you can get the new books and stuff like that. So masscrossroads.com, check it out. And thanks again for coming on the show.
Thanks. I really appreciate it, Tim. I really enjoy talking with you, and anytime you want to go and see if we can get into another adventure and I can lose another car, please feel free to call me up. So
that does it for this week's edition of BOA Audio Season 3. Big, big, super huge thanks to Chris Balzano for coming on the show. Telling you folks, Breakout Star 2008, Chris Balzano, keep an eye on this guy. You can find out more information on Chris at the website www.masscrossroads.com. Check it out. Little in-house notes time, of course. We already talked about the podcast feed problems. Check that out at the beginning of the show if you missed it somehow. We're getting a new podcast feed, in-house podcast feed, very reliable. We'll make sure it does not go down again. So stay tuned for more information on that. Nothing else really going on, percolating on the big projects, BOA DC and BOA After Hours. Hopefully we'll have more information on those items next week as we kick off March. And now, call your friends, wake your neighbors. It's time for BOA Audio Listener Feedback. Let's dive right in here with a very interesting letter from someone billed only as Tobias/Durr. I'm not sure if that's two names or I've never seen the slash between the names, but it's Tobias/Durr. And here's what Tobias has to say. I was rather unhappy with the Sci-Fi Channel putting a guy on a bed and letting us hear that he was abducted by aliens, but later when they were done, he was placed nicely in his bed with his, quote, underwear on backwards, unquote. BS. This is bad stuff, people. What is worse, bad aliens or bad actors? This is not UFO hunting. People, they are out there for real. Wake up. Tobias/Durr. There you go. That's a haunting email, my friends. I haven't really even checked out either of the UFO Hunters shows. As soon as I heard they were kind of going in the direction of Ghost Hunters, I was very disappointed with the whole idea, and I was like, fuck that. I'm really not a big Ghost Hunters fan, so when you apply that concept to UFOs, I don't care. I'm not interested. You've seen one of those shows, you've seen them all. Apparently the Sci-Fi Channel UFO Hunters was a one-and-done thing, so I don't even know what's going on with that. But I have been reading some of the stuff on UFO Hunters on History Channel. Looks pretty good, and I did check out like 5 minutes of it. Thank you so much for writing in, Tobias. Thank you for your interesting perspective on the UFO Hunters story. If you want to be a part of BOA Audio Listener Feedback, here's how you do it. Either write to boaaudio@hotmail.com. or go to banalofamerica.com and click contact. Either one of those methods takes your correspondence beyond the velvet rope and into BOA Audio Listener Feedback. Now, of course, you know the time of the program. It is the thanks portion of the show. Soon you're going to be hearing from these people. Soon you're going to be hearing from the fantastic BOA staff on BOA Audio After Hours. But for now, let me just give them a thanks here at the end of the program. They are, of course, Leslie, Chiron, Arlie, Jovi, Tina Senna, and Rochelle Hawks, the outstanding, top-notch, world-class BOA staff. If you're only listening to BOA Audio and you're not reading the columns at banalofamerica.com, you're only getting half the story. Stop by BOA and find out why so many are making Banal of America part of their everyday search for esoteric news and opinion. Speaking of which, of course, Banal of America, we are growing week in, week out. We are growing month after month. So many people discovering the website, downloading stuff, and of course, so many new episodes of the program. This sort of thing costs money, believe it or not. It's just not, we don't have a magical tree of esoterica here where we can just pluck things. It costs money for the phone calls, it costs money for the hosting of the show, it costs money for a plethora of little things that you'd be surprised by. But in general, it costs money. And we don't charge We don't have ads on the show. We don't do anything really to generate money except for the store. And, of course, our calls here at the end of the program for donations. If you can help support the audio series and the website, please, please make a donation at BenAllOfAmerica.com. Click the PayPal button. No donation is too small, and all donations go towards keeping BOA and BOA Audio up and running and freely available for all of our great listeners the world over. Next week on the program, we're going to hold off just a bit here and not announce anyone just yet. The facts of the matter are simple, my friends. I have a couple of interviews already in the can, but they're kind of along the lines of stuff we've already done here in February, and I wanted to get someone in with a little bit of a different perspective on things. I want to do something a little bit different from what we've already presented here in February before we sort of revisit some of the themes of February later on in March. So I got on the horn with a big player in one of the major fields in Esoterica, and he was down for a BOA audio return. So he is penciled in here for next week to tape, and once I tape the interview, we'll post the preview on the website so folks can find out who it's going to be. It's within the realm of ufology. I'll even tease that out a little more. In the event that the interview doesn't go off as planned, we already have something in the can, so we'll definitely have an episode next week, no matter what. Rain or shine, sleet or snow, there will be an episode. And on that mysterious and confusing note, we're going to bid you adieu here this week. Thank you so much for listening, folks. It's been a little bit rocky here in the middle of February. I apologize for that. Stay tuned. More great episodes coming up around the bend. More great, exciting stuff coming up from BOA. Until you hear from me next week, thanks again for listening, folks. This is Tim Benall, signing off.